heard the story about the old miser, Frank. Frank was dying. He was on his deathbed. He called in his doctor, his lawyer, and his pastor. Frank, in a gruff manner, said to them, "I know you're not able to take it with you, but I'm going to be the exception." So he hands the doctor, his doctor, an envelope with $100,000 cash in it. He said to the doctor at my funeral service, "Just as they are lowering the lid on the casket, I want you to slip in this envelope." He turned to his lawyer and he said to the lawyer, "I have an envelope for you and it has $100,000 in it. Just as they are lowering the lid on the casket at my funeral, I want you to put that envelope in as well." Then he turned to the pastor, his pastor, and he said, "And I have an envelope for you, $100,000 cash. At my funeral, when they are lowering the lid on the casket, I want you to slip in the envelope with the $100,000 cash." Well, the day of the funeral eventually came, and sure enough, just as the lid on the casket was closing, the three men did what they promised. But after the three men were together, and a conscience-stricken doctor said to the other fellows, "Men, I have a confession. When it came time, as the lid was lowered on the casket, I put in the envelope, but I had taken out $50,000. Said, "I'm building a new clinic." And he said, "I took the $50,000 out for that purpose, leaving the rest in it." Well, the lawyer was a bit sheepish. The lawyer said, "Well, I have a confession. When I put the envelope in, there was only $25,000 left." He said, "After all, I'm a lawyer. I charge big fees for handling money." He said, "So I kept $75,000 and it only left $25,000 in the envelope." Well, the pastor, he said to the two men, "I am absolutely ashamed of you. For me, when the lid was being lowered on the casket, I put in a check to Frank for the full amount." Think about it. I'll get any ideas. But who can you trust these days? Have you ever been ripped off? Have you ever had somebody break their promises when it comes to financial matters? Have you ever chased after a deal that seems too good to be true, only to discover that indeed it is too good to be true? Who can you trust? And let me ask, can you be trusted when it comes to money and material possessions? Trusting and being trusted, especially when it comes to money and giving. Can you trust politicians these days? Do you have full confidence when it comes to what happens to your tax dollar? Can you trust the charities that you donate to? What about community organizations? Have you ever heard of someone embezzling within a community organization? What about missions? Millions and millions of dollars go to church missions. Can those people be trusted? What about in your family? You have impeccable trust in your spouse? Do you trust your children when it comes to financial resources? Have you ever had to deal with fragile feelings when it comes to an estate or when it comes to a family member who has borrowed money from you? Can God be trusted? God makes lots and lots of promises when it comes to money and material possessions. Can you put your full confidence in God? Well, I also have to ask you, can God trust you? God is the one who owns everything. He is the one who is the owner of all of your possessions. All that you have belongs to Him. He has entrusted, He has called you to be a steward of those funds. Can you be trusted in these kinds of matters? The problem is we're living in a day where there are many ethical pitfalls. Get-rich schemes are everywhere. The idea of ripping off others is prevalent around us. If you're like me, you crave for that Proverbs 31 woman. We mentioned her last week, Mother's Day, and said when it comes to the poor, she extends her arms, her hands are open to the needs of the poor. When it comes to this matter of trust, we read in Proverbs 31 that her family, and specifically her husband, has full confidence. The Hebrew word meaning he trusts her when it comes to financial matters and possessions. Can you and I be trusted? This morning I have entitled our sermon, Integrity and Giving. The notion of handling money with integrity, especially integrity in the area of giving and generosity. And, believe it or not, we'll even touch on the area of fundraising. Let's do a quick recap. I got a lot of feedback from last Sunday. A bit surprised, but it showed me that there is an interest in this topic matter. We talked about how Paul initiated a special appeal for the poor saints in Jerusalem who were struggling at the time due to persecution, due to famine. There were many other factors. At the beginning of chapter 8, Paul points to the Corinthians, the example of the Macedonians. Though they were dirt poor and picked on, these people begged for the opportunity to give to this special project to Jerusalem. Paul uses that example, combined with the ultimate example of Jesus, to challenge the Corinthians in two ways. They had begun this special offering for the church in Jerusalem. They now needed to bring it to completion. They needed to stop procrastinating and finish what they had started. And then Paul said to them, and indeed it's a challenge for all of us even to this day, he said, excel in giving. There's so many things you do so well, but be sure that when it comes to this area of life, that you excel in this matter of giving. Paul doesn't use gimmicks, nor does he twist the arm and use guilt. His appeal when it comes to motivation is at the level of grace. If you've been saved by grace, the evidence of that, you're not saved by giving, but you sure are saved to give, saved to be generous and to be helpful to others. So having addressed in the first part of chapter 8 the matter of motivation, now Paul moves on to the area of method. Now, full disclosure, I've been around for a while when it comes to life and when it comes to ministry. I've never, ever heard anyone preach on the last part of 2 Corinthians 8. Smart preachers address the first part of the chapter and quickly move into chapter 9. But this morning, maybe because I'm not a smart pastor, we're going to park on the latter part of chapter 8, and we're going to be looking at some insights when it comes to the methodology, when it comes to the integrity that needs to be the driving force behind giving and generosity, no matter what side of the fence you are on. I want to appeal to those of you who our givers, which should be all of us. And I'm even going to appeal today to those of you either here in this church or in mission organizations you represent who are involved in the receiving of the generous gifts of others. What we're going to do today is we're going to have a little case study, which is going to be based on the last part of chapter 8. And then I'm going to make a couple of observations and present you with three or four, I hope, very practical lessons when it comes to this text. Some of these lessons, quite frankly, are lessons that in the typical course of a church calendar just don't get addressed. But we're going to be brave this morning and deal with some of these issues. So the case study is built on 2 Corinthians 8, where we left off last week, verse 16 to the end of the chapter, and these words are going to be on the screen behind me. Paul writes, "I thank God who put into the heart of Titus the same concern I have for you. For Titus not only welcomed our appeal, but he is coming to you with much enthusiasm and on his own initiative. We are sending along with him the brother who is praised by all the churches for his service to the gospel. What is more, he was chosen by the churches to accompany us as we carry the offering, which we administer in order to honor the Lord himself and to show our eagerness to help. We want to avoid any criticism of the way we administer this liberal gift. For we are taking pains to do what is right, not only in the eyes of the Lord, but also in the eyes of men. In addition, we are sending with them our brother, who has often proved to us in many ways that he is zealous, and now even more so because of his great confidence in you. As for Titus, he is my partner and fellow worker among you. As for our brothers, they are representatives of the churches and an honor to Christ. Therefore, show these men the proof of your love and the reason for our pride in you so that the churches can see it." Case study and a few observations. How easy would be, we'd have a super short sermon on a holiday Sunday, if Paul had just said after motivating the Corinthians, "Now, when it comes to methodology, when it comes to how we're going to handle the money that you've raised, just trust me." Be one of the shortest paragraphs in the whole of the Bible. "Don't you trust me? Just trust me. Don't worry about it. I'll deal with it. I'll handle it." I mean, after all, Paul had what seems to be greater priorities. He was responsible for spreading the gospel to the ends of the earth. He was pastoring over many, many churches. He had his hands full. You would think that for Paul, this would be regarded as a very secondary, a matter of little importance. Compared to some of the other things going on in his life, think about the great rescues he talks about, the hardships. I don't know about you, but there's a part of me that would go, I wish Paul had elaborated on some of the godly rescues in his life, some of the hardships he endured. Heather and I have a little phrase when she was teaching Sunday school a lot, we would talk about what we called a non-story. Well, in many ways, this passage we just read seems like a non-story. I mean, what do you do with it? It seems like the kind of thing that you would discover in a church business meeting. I mean, it doesn't really seem to grab you. But Paul sees this as very important. Shouldn't surprise us after last Sunday. Because Paul sees financial matters as spiritual matters. Paul doesn't compartmentalize life in that way. Back next Sunday, make sure you're here, because Paul is going to be talking about the blessings and the benefits that come with giving and generosity. All of us need to hear that message next Sunday. Paul has already argued that giving and generosity is evidences of your faith, and very important. Hey, did you see the paper yesterday I hope you read it, some of you, the London Free Press, and there was an article, the Agnes Reed Institute have done a major survey and have determined that with faith comes altruism. In other words, people of faith tend to help others more than people who do not identify with a faith group. Are you surprised? And in fact, you need to read that article if you didn't get a chance. I'm expecting that over the next few days, there's going to be a lot of feedback. But it is an evidence of faith. It's what people look to. It's what God says you need to look at as a test of your faith. So no wonder Paul sees this as an important issue. God ultimately took the initiative when it came to this special project to the churches in Jerusalem. Randy Alcorn has said this, "Our approach to money and material possessions just isn't important, it's central to our spiritual lives. Our giving is a reflective response to the grace of God in our lives. It comes out of the transformational work of Christ in us." Wow. Giving and generosity is way more important than I think many of us would understand it. So for Paul, this is so important, the matter of money, material possessions, and giving and generosity. Without apology, he spends much time talking about it. But he also wants to deal with this matter of the fundraising part of it. And so for Paul, it becomes obvious that it's not just that money and material possessions are important, but how you fundraise in Christian community must be done very, very well. It must be done humbly, and it must be done right, and above all, with integrity. We read in this passage that when Paul talks about administering, a word that causes some of us to shake a little bit, administration. But when Paul talks about it in this context, administration honors God and it helps others. Interesting enough, when Paul looks at the idea of giving and generosity helping, he's not only saying at a practical level it's going to help the poor saints in Jerusalem, but he has the audacity to argue that when you give, you are helping yourself, you're benefiting. You are going to grow. You are going to experience blessing. And so for Paul, like Titus, they were greatly concerned that the Corinthians excel in this matter. In order for that excelling, Paul recognized that the funds needed to be administered well. Now, he had an added incentive, and we're going to pick up on this, especially in 3 or 4 weeks when we look at 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Paul had opponents. He had some enemies in Corinth. And some of them did not like the fact that Paul did not take a salary from the Corinthians. Now, we do know that Paul received support from the Macedonian churches. But the accusation was that Paul was exploiting. He was a guy who would kind of skim off the top. And I'm sure there was suspicion when it came to this special project offering. And for that reason, Paul knew that he was being watched. And that would be added incentive for Paul to make sure that he was handling this matter well. Paul is going to rigorously defend his integrity, but he's not going to dismiss the matter of integrity either. Does that make sense? So he will defend his integrity, but Paul at no point says this issue of integrity doesn't matter. So for Paul, it becomes a matter of priority when it comes to how this was being handled. He had three fellows who were going to be instrumental in the collection and distribution of the funds. Titus, a man who the Corinthians knew to be trustworthy and honorable. Then we have the fellow that's anonymous. He's sometimes called the famous brother. Interesting enough, isn't it, that he was appointed by the churches in Macedonia, and we're told they elected him. Was it a vote? Was it a show of hands? But I think we need to pay attention that he truly was a representative. Paul didn't handpick him, but this fellow had a good reputation, especially when it came into matters of the gospel. The third fellow who's listed later in the chapter, given the position that he assumes, he could be called a junior brother, maybe a younger man who is learning the ropes, but again, a fellow with a good reputation and great credentials. For Paul, this wasn't a matter of doing it all by himself. Paul was not a lone ranger in any form of ministry, especially when it came to the matter of raising funds. Well, I want to get specific, and I want to look at some lessons, a couple of observations and then lessons. I'm going to give you a formula. Are you ready for it? Integrity times accountability equals trust. You got it? I didn't put it on the screen, but I think you can remember that one. Say it with me. Integrity times accountability equals trust. One last time. Integrity times accountability equals trust. Now, when we talk about integrity, what do we mean? I've used the word several times. It's come up at other points during our series. The word integrity comes from the word integer, and if you're a mathematician, you know that it refers to completeness or wholeness. And there's no room for fractions. And of course, that's our dilemma, isn't it? Lord, I'm 80% committed to you. And the Lord says, no, I want you to be a man or a woman of integrity. I want all your life, not just most of it or a part of it. Or when it comes to the matter of finances, you know, 90% of the time, I'm trustworthy. There's just this little, you know, just maybe 10%. Integrity means wholeness. It means completeness. The verses behind me, let's go to the next slide. I had them boldened, just in case you're wondering if that's how Paul asked the passage to be written. No, it was boldened for our sake today. This really, to me, is the main takeaway today, where Paul is putting this priority on integrity. Paul was very, very sensitive to the area of integrity. I have met lots and lots of people who are insensitive to integrity. It's not a big deal. There are maybe a few people who are oversensitive. I would actually argue maybe Paul could be accused of being oversensitive when it came to integrity. But it was a big deal for Paul. He knew that a lot was riding on the integrity behind the taking up of this collection. I was a young guy, and this is way back at a church that we attended in my birthplace, Orillia. And there was a man who, at the time, I thought highly of. He was a good fellow on the platform, loved music, actually a very good musician. But he got the idea that there was this project that people should invest in. And he was a very charismatic kind of guy and managed to convince 6-7 men in the church to get behind this project, to invest in it. It was a terrible investment. The fellow misled the investors. It was an absolute mess. I'm not sure why my dad got involved. He was not one of the investors, but he was actually called in by the church to help sort it out. I will say this of my dad. I admire his integrity. He was known for that in business, and he was known for that in the church. But I still remember overhearing my dad say to my mom, I can't believe, we'll call this fellow R, which initial his first name, can't believe his lack of sensitivity. It doesn't bother him that he lacks integrity. It doesn't bother him that he ripped off so many good people in our church. As a young guy, I found that very disturbing. You know what I find even more disturbing? I want to talk about the sins of the father. I know some of this fellow's descendants. I know a couple of his sons, and I know a couple of his grandchildren. And that lack of integrity has been passed down the line. Tragic. Very talented family, but they lack integrity. Let me tell you about one of my great mentors, Bob. That is his name. Met Bob at my mom's funeral reception, and Bob is in his early 90s and still going strong. Bob had been a very successful businessman with Bell Canada, was one of their top leaders, and had a reputation there as being a man of integrity. He brought it into our church setting, and in our church setting in Toronto, he was my mentor. They still say that he was one of the best field supervisors that the seminary has ever known, and I was the recipient of his excellent work in that way. But I still remember when one of the deacons in our church, which I have on my notes, he was a bit of a jerk. I'm not sure if that's a good word to use in our setting this morning, but it fits. He was a jerk. And he accused Bob of a lack of integrity when it came to his summer vacation in his role at the church. Now, what pleases me is there were many men who came to Bob's defense. But as a young guy in my early 20s, what I remember was how hurt Bob was, how sensitive he was when it came to this matter of integrity. Not only was it a principle he operated on, but he wanted to make sure he had a very good reputation when it came to the matter of integrity. One last story, because I want to draw even more people in. I had a friend years ago, and S, a good guy, but he went through a rough patch, and in desperation, decided to hit some people up at the church for some money, always under the premise that he was just going to need it for a while. Could I borrow $100? I'll pay it back in a month. I'll never forget having a small delegation of men, a couple of women coming to me saying, John, we know you're a friend of us. He's made all these promises, but hasn't paid anyone back. I remember going to S. And though S is a good guy, he said to me, well, you know, all the people I approached are quite well off. He said, I'm sure that they're not going to miss the money. And I said, S, whether you borrowed $2 or $2,000, it's your reputation and your integrity that's on the line. I wish I could tell you that S paid back every single one of those people, but if there was a lesson I learned, it was, hey, if you're going to borrow money and you promise to pay it back, you pay it back, right? Don't just assume that that's not a relevant manner. A real stretch of an aside. You know, I hope you know as a church, that a couple of us have a responsibility to administer the Helping Hurting Family Fund. Me and Jerry Mills. Good, we've got two of us involved. Can I let you in on a little secret? There have been a few times where somebody has approached me and said, John, could I borrow out of the Helping Hurting Family Fund this amount? And I'm always quick to say, we really don't want you to borrow it. We will gift it to you. And if God determines that you're able to make that up in whatever appropriate way, then that would be appropriate. But let me go on record. I am not a fan of people borrowing from the church. If that bothers you, you can talk to me afterwards, but it's an integrity issue. And in fact, let's even go further, because I want to provoke some thought that you'll be able to talk at lunch today about this sermon I'm not even a big fan of extensive borrowing within families. Gifting is one thing, but I could write a book on families I've dealt with where borrowing very quickly goes south. That's something you can think about? Is that something you can wrestle with? And I'm not even asking you now to agree or disagree, but again, we're dealing with this matter of integrity. It's a matter of what's right. Grace needs to triumph over gimmicks and guilt. Did you also notice that Paul's operating at arm's length? He isn't handpicking the guys. In fact, the second fellow is one that the church has elected. You know the question I get asked a lot, especially by other pastors? So, John, what time of the day on Monday do you get to review what people gave in the offering on Sunday? And you need to know, in 30 years of ministry, I've never done that. I don't want to do it. The elders don't want me to do it. I don't want the elders here at Byron to do it. We take measures to ensure that there's arm's length. Does that sound like a good idea? I really believe it is. Oh, I know the argument is, well, if giving is a spiritual matter, then shouldn't the pastor have more insight into what people are giving? But again, my experience would suggest that that can go south pretty quickly. We may give preferential treatment to someone because we know they give more than another. And I think Paul had the right idea. He ensured that he was operating at arm's length, doing the right thing. In fact, someone described integrity as doing the right thing whether or not someone else is looking. But you know what Paul says in these verses? Others are watching. So not only is it an incentive at a personal level, but be sure God sees all, doesn't he? You're not fooling God. It's not a case of you going, I haven't put anything in the offering for the last 3 months, but I don't think God has noticed. It doesn't work that way. And others, through the path of life, will know whether or not you are trustworthy or a man or a woman of integrity in these matters. Integrity, lots of incentive. Melissa's here today. As a young girl, she told us her favorite Bible story was the story of Ananias and Sapphira in Acts chapter 5. I still find that quite comical. You maybe need to read that passage later today. You remember Ananias and Sapphira had that piece of land. They kept most of the funds for themselves. They tried to pretend they were giving it all. And we're told that when they confessed, they dropped dead. So there's a little bit of incentive. I hope that's not manipulative, but that passage has always made me think twice about trying to get away with anything where God is concerned. But can I say this? We've talked a lot about integrity, but I have a concern. It's a twofold concern. First is, integrity is not easy. If I have in any way gave you the feeling today that integrity is just, hey, it's a piece of cake. It's not easy. It is complicated. And not only that, we need help when it comes to integrity. Who needs help? Can I say this without offending you? Every single one of us needs help when it comes to integrity. And that's why I'm a big fan of the A word. It's not a bad word. You need it. You need it. You need it. I especially need it. And it's the word accountability. Accountability encourages integrity. Did you catch that? Accountability encourages integrity. Three brothers. Paul was being very open, very transparent, no secrets. Paul was being accountable to the churches in Macedonia and even to the church in Corinth as well. We could write a book on where accountability and integrity come together. Here at Byron, our personnel do not count offerings on their own. Not a good idea. Wouldn't it be a lot easier if Somebody just did it all by himself or herself, or maybe even better, because, you know, after service, people are hungry and need to get on their way. Is it such a big deal if someone just took the offering home with them and counted it there at his convenience? I remember years and years ago, a fellow who had a responsibility that way, it was a busy Sunday, and he took the offering home with him. He was talking to me a couple of days after that. Said, John, what do you think? I said, you know what? I love you a whole lot, but I think that's a really bad idea. And then he said, and with a bit of a wink, John, don't you trust me? I said, I do trust you, but that's not the issue. That's not the issue. It's about integrity. It's about accountability. It's about even perception. And so, yeah, we take some measures even here at the church. Because you know what? When it comes to the money that you give sacrificially, it needs to be handled well. Amen? You want to make sure that we're doing everything we can do to make sure it's being done well. Hey, audits. At our last general meeting, I found it very interesting. And we kind of have, don't we, around Byron, a trinity. We've got Ron Burns, our esteemed treasurer. Orly Friesen looks after the offering envelopes and the counting. But then we have this third member of the Holy Trinity, Gord Street. I've never met Gord Street, but I've heard his name a whole lot. I sometimes wonder, is he a big guy? Is he a small guy? He seems like kind of like the Holy Spirit part of the Trinity. He's invisible. I can just only imagine what he's like. I don't want to be out of turn here, but we pay good money for the auditing process. I'm not even sure that it's absolutely mandatory that we are audited, but don't you think it's a great thing? I have confidence when I know that Ron spends a whole lot of time with Gord Street and we get reports back at the leadership level. And then when we come to an annual meeting, we're told that an outside person has done some checks and balances and he's looked at things to make sure that everything is appropriate. I'm aware of a fairly large organization in this part of the city where the treasurer ripped off the organization of lots and lots of money. And over time, I know that our family and others were part of that organization. And you wonder, what happened? Why could that happen? And the common denominator, I'm not a financial guy, but you know the common denominator is way too much power given to that one person. Where is the checks and balances? Where is the auditing? So yeah, we take those measures to make sure, like Paul, that things are being done very, very well. I'm on a roll on my application here. Let's go into your family life. And this, I'm going to step on a couple of toes here. So make sure your feet are protected on this one. When I do premarital counseling, and I've done it here and other places for many, many years, when we talk about financial matters, I am a great believer. I could be accused of overcoaching when it comes to the matter of joint accounts. I believe in it. I'm a stickler on it. You may be saying, well, John, my wife and I have had our separate accounts and we've gotten by for 40 years or 20 years. Blessings to you. My strong conviction is that a marriage partnership where the two are one, there should be something that closely resembles a joint account. In marriage, in family life, there should be no secrets. Are there risks with joint accounts? You better believe it. So when Heather checks up on me and says, John, I think you were out a couple of times that you didn't tell me about to Tim's or McDonald's, my back does go. I'm going to have to be honest today. My back goes up. I'm going, I'm in my 50s. I don't need... And then I go, wait a second. Accountability encourages integrity. So my appeal is that it's not just a church thing. In family life, you need that degree of integrity as well. And let me ask, this is a tough one. Who can ask you the tough questions that come with how you handle money and material possessions? That has to be repeated. This to me is the accountability question. Who in your life, and actually I prefer it not be your spouse, say, well, my son, he doesn't know a lot about finances, so yeah, I'll give him permission. You need to say, Lord, direct me to someone, and I want to give that person permission to ask the tough. And I'm not talking about your banker. I'm talking about somebody who can talk about your values and your choices and your priorities. And if we're serious about accountability, then to me the real test is there someone I'm going to give permission to ask those tough questions? Somebody has said recently that these days we're way more open and transparent when it comes to our sex life over our finances. And I realize for some people, the area of finances is a taboo subject. Some of you are thinking, oh, John, this message, I'm afraid in the next 2 minutes you're going to have a slide on the screen that somehow you have communicated with God and he's going to reveal all the intricate financial details in my life. No, we're not going there. But I am suggesting that maybe the best takeaway for you this morning is to say, Lord, direct me to that person. Maybe an older person, somebody who has had more experience in the realities of life. But accountability is an area that matters. Integrity times accountability equals trust. And as we are transforming stewards like you to be rich towards God and giving in generosity, the focus of last week and the focus of next week's message, we need to realize that it will be compromised when there's a lack of integrity. I can preach the sermon of the century on giving and generosity. If the foundation isn't rooted in integrity, it's compromised. It's for a waste. We need that approach. I want to close this morning. I was able to, through a lot of searching and wrestling and going through a lot, I found an article, and I want to leave you this morning with four lessons. This is an article called Lessons Learned from the Underbelly. There's a great title. It is subtitled How to Raise Resources with Integrity. It's written by Paul Nelson for the years 1994 to 2006. He was the president of the Evangelical Council for Financial Accountability. It's a big watchdog group. There are at least 1,200 Christian organizations and missions that belong to the Evangelical Council for Financial Accountability. It's like a watchdog group that have a responsibility in that area. So he gives four lessons when it comes to raising resources with integrity. And you might go, well, John, I only am able to give 50 bucks to the church once in a while, but you still want to make sure that that $50 is used well and appropriately. And as I said, some of you this morning have been tasked with the awesome responsibility of handling finances. And for you, the takeaway is it's a wonderful privilege and a great responsibility. Here are the four lessons. Lesson number one, he uses labels. So it's the danger of rationalization. Nelson argues one of the reasons why there's ethical pitfalls is that we rationalize. It's where we lower the standards when it comes to integrity and accountability. And he gives some reasons for rationalizations. One is the tyranny of the urgent. What Paul did in 2 Corinthians 8 took time, it took effort, and it needed to be plotted over a long course of time. Even when it comes to family life, you and your wife have come to an agreement that anything spent over $300 requires a conversation. It requires a discussion. But you're out shopping. and it's a deal. And there's only three left. And you're going, oh, well, you know, I know we've got this understanding, but it's urgent. Problem with the tyranny of the urgent is the urgent becomes the pattern, and then you find yourself always slipping in this way. Yeah, there's going to be emergencies. There may be the exception once in a while, but watch out for the tyranny of the urgent. Also, under the danger of rationalization, Nelson says, there's what he calls ethical laziness. This is sometimes too hard. It might take too much time, and we need to be careful with that. The end justifying the means. The idea, well, if it works, it must be of God. And that's why he suggests, I agree, that gimmicks should never be part of a Christian organization strategy. Guilt should not be part of our method. And truth-telling should always be a great priority. He tells the story of a mission organization that were out to feed the hungry on a holiday weekend. And they put out flyers saying they needed to raise funds for this big dinner they were putting on. What they didn't tell people was that a local grocery store had offered to supply food, and in fact, they had already had in their possession 95% of what they needed. What ended up happening was this Christian organization ended up with way more funds than they needed for the dinner, but they rationalized that they have lots of expenses throughout the year, and that money was funneled into their operating expense. Not a good thing. And as Nelson argues, that's rationalizing and often happens much too often. The second and third lessons I'm going to just touch on. Second is reporting fundraising costs. I would love to have known what Paul's administration costs were. I know that he had Macedonian support, we know because of the opposition it was an issue. They were convinced that Paul was taking a healthy percentage of the funds for his own support. The two or three lessons, I think, out of this general lesson, reporting fundraising costs, you are entitled to ask an organization, what percentage goes to administration? It's a good question. It's a necessary question. You know, a lot of organizations have the pie. You've seen the pie chart, and I think you're entitled to do that. In fact, I'm going to even be this bold. I believe that mission committees should make it a priority to ask missionaries what percentage of funds that we direct to you are going to you and what goes to administrative costs. What I've been told by many churches and many people is it's not something that happens often enough. It's a good issue. It's a good question. But can I give you a caution? There are a number of variables. And sometimes there's unfair comparisons. You might say, well, this organization, their administration cost is 15%, another organization is 12%. But often the issue is how these numbers are reported. And to me, not only am I asking what's the percentage, but how have you arrived at those numbers? Are we dealing with accurate numbers? But again, Nelson argues that we need to encourage the reporting of fundraising costs. Third is the use of designated giving. And you will notice, this needs to be said, that in 1st and 2nd Corinthians, the priority giving is always giving to the general fund. In 1 Corinthians 9, in 1 Corinthians 16, Paul says that you're to give regularly and systematically. It generally is going to the operational costs of the church and salaries, as we see in 1 Corinthians 9. There are special projects. They have their place. And I think in church life, we always need to see it that way. But in no place in 2 Corinthians 8 do I see Paul saying, what you need to do is take your funds and put them into the special project and ignore the general giving. And it's why we don't always say this at Byron, but I believe it's very biblical with a special project. It is above and over your general giving. Does that make sense? And I'm arguing it's very, very biblical. And also you'll notice with a special project that it's the leadership that takes initiative. I'm not a big fan, maybe you can tell, of designated giving in a general sense. I always see that the leaders take initiative, and then there's a directive designated giving. So there's no randomness. It's not like the people at Corinth saying, I think it'd be kind of nice to divert some of our funds to this special project or this group of poor people in Jerusalem. It was at Paul's initiative and Paul's direction. So we need to be careful in these areas. Finally, the final lesson is what Nelson calls respect for the giver. And I love this about Paul. I love this about Titus. This concern they had for the Macedonians, for the Corinthians, and for the people of Jerusalem. Paul has already said earlier in chapter 8, don't overlook proportional giving. And I hope you never, ever feel, Byron, that we're asking you to give too much. As I said last week, it's about attitude way more than it's about amount. And as leaders, we should never, ever ask you to give in a way that is manipulative. Manipulation, gimmicks, guilt aren't allowed. I was just a boy. I was 13. I had been part of a boys' brigade program at a church in Scarborough. I enjoyed it, but I have very few memories of it. But I do remember one incident. The year was finishing with a closing dinner. We were encouraged to bring our dads to the boys' brigade evening. And I remember eagerly going up to Dad and saying, Dad, it's a free dinner. And Dad had been brought up in that denomination. I won't mention the name of the denomination, but he said, I've never heard of anything being done within this movement that's free. I said, but Dad, don't worry. We've been told by the leaders that it's a free dinner. It's a free dinner to bring your dads. And I was so excited. So we get to the evening. It was a good dinner. And then at the end of the night, it was the pastor of all people. And the pastor announces, my wife and I were out 3 nights ago, and we had a dinner that wasn't this good, and it cost us $75 each. Now he said, let that govern what you're going to give in our free will offering. As a boy, I didn't even know what the term free will offering meant. But you know what I do remember? This was well over 40 years ago. I don't remember, I really don't remember anything about 2 years of the Boys Brigade program. What I remember as a 13-year-old was being major league disrespected. Isn't that tragic? That's the memory that lasts. We can never, ever afford to disrespect those who give. And I want to take this opportunity in this unusual message, to thank you for your faithful, sacrificial giving to Byron Community Church. John Mackey does not do what he does without your support and your giving. Josh Kennedy would not be here to entertain us during announcements and to do fine work. We have missionaries. Many missionaries who count on your support. As a church, I know there's expenses that are not exciting. Who gets excited about paying the hydro bill? But you're making it possible for this church to further the gospel of Jesus Christ. I don't want you to leave this morning feeling guilty. I know some of you are up against it when it comes to financial circumstances. Hey, if that's you, you got to be here next week. Can I beg you to be here next week? It might be the most important sermon you've heard in your lifetime when we look at 2 Corinthians 9. But I want to thank those of you who are givers, and I want to thank those at Byron Community Church who regularly and behind the scenes handle our funds with integrity. And you need to thank the Lord when you have appropriate time just to say, Ron, Orly, there's many others, thank you for what you do. No, it's not glamorous, and I know that you may not always get pats on the back. And somebody like a Carol who faithfully does a lot of the bookkeeping, can I say from my vantage point, we are blessed with men and women who are handling funds with integrity. They belong to God, but we've been appointed to manage them. Let's stand and pray, and then we're going to have two songs to close off with this morning. Just ask right now, heads bowed, eyes closed, say, Lord, what do you want me to take away this morning? For some of you, you're saying, Lord, you know I have not been giving with excellence. In fact, I really haven't been giving much at all. But God, you know why, and you know what I'm dealing with. I touched a nerve with a couple of you this morning because a couple of you have been ripped off. A couple of you are dealing with some family matters that are very complicated when it comes to money. Some of you are in Christian organizations, and you have been appointed to administer funds well. I pray that God will impress on you some lessons this morning that you can take away. We have some younger people here today. Now is the time to establish good patterns of giving and generosity. You won't be disappointed. Father, search our hearts. Help us to be men and women of integrity. Thank you that, Jesus, when you left the riches of heaven, give your life for us. It was all about grace. And Father, for those who have been graced with your love, we thank you that we now have an opportunity to be part of your service.